So I have no financial relationships to disclose because I don't have the money anymore that Dave was talking about. So, and I will not discuss any off-label use of medications here. So I want to say a word about Carl Taube. This is the 25th year since Carl died. Carl died in 1989. And Carl was my good friend. He was my colleague and mentor in the National Institute of Mental Health. I succeeded him as the person who operated the National Reporting Program in Mental Health Statistics. I also succeeded him as the first branch chief to have the program in mental health services research that Dave was talking about. So Carl went on beyond that to create the field of mental health economics. So anybody in here who does research in that area can thank Carl Taube that that field exists. He also went on to have a second career after he left the National Institute of Mental Health at Johns Hopkins. And in that phase of his career, he did a lot of work with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, particularly helping them understand who their members were, helping to develop policies in that organization, and so on. So he's a tremendous person and is very, very deserving of having this award named after him. So I'm just very, very pleased to be able to receive the award on the 25th anniversary of his death. I also want to remember consumers who have died. Every one of us sitting in this room know consumers who have died prematurely for a whole host of reasons, because they didn't get primary care, because of lifestyle factors like smoking and being homeless, because of the secondary effects of psychotropic meds and so on. So we want to remember all those people and their contribution to this field. Many advocates who I've known over the years, Howie the Harp as an example, died at a very young age. And we want to remember them so that they didn't die in vain and that we actually do something about the issue of why they died. Imagination without execution is fantasy. So a lot of us have wonderful imagination. We have difficulty translating it into anything. So I took this and I changed it and said, integration without execution is fantasy. Integration without execution. So I'm going to try to talk our way into integration here. Without any doubt, the key issue confronting behavioral health today is how to execute effective integration with primary care. It's a huge, huge issue. I can go anywhere in the United States and this is being talked about. And I think part of our issue as a field is we are scared of integration. We need to say that. We need to then deal with that so we can move ahead. And in fact, integration is not going to eliminate behavioral health care. In fact, there's going to be much more work for behavioral health care, and I hope to make that case as I go through these overheads. This is also an issue of social justice. And let me say a word about that. So back in 1944, when Franklin Roosevelt did his State of the Union address in the White House, he then went into his inner office and he recorded a second talk on basic human rights. And the very first right he talked about was the idea that everyone ought to have the right to have good health. This was 1944. Now, in 1935, his administration already had plans to do Social Security, to do health reform, and to do welfare reform. The politicos said, you're never going to get all this through. Pick one, and we'll do that, and then you can do these others later. So he picked Social Security. I think in 1944, he was getting ready to ramp up on health reform, because World War II was ramping down at that time. Never happened. Now it's more than 60 years later, we are finally doing and beginning to do what his vision entailed. So one part of social justice here is the basic idea that everyone ought to have the right to have good health. The second feature of social justice here is we value all people equally. You have to ask that of yourself. Do you value all people equally? Do I? Does your organization value all people equally? Does the local county government or the state government value all people equally and so on? We really need to ask that. Now, social justice is about valuing all people equally. So if you go back to everyone ought to have the right to have good health, and we value all people equally, you can do nothing other than the Affordable Care Act or something just like the Affordable Care Act, because what it's doing is reducing disparities and promoting equity, which is what social justice is about. And actually, Shariki will remember this, when we did the committee on Healthy People 2020, we were kind of horrified to find out, I guess, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and this is about in, I would say, 2008, had no common definition of disparity or equity. It had no common, and the 2000 version of Healthy People had, in fact, had as its primary goal reducing disparities. Well, how do you do that if you don't have any definition? So we actually took this on, and we did a lot of work on this, and we published a paper in the American Journal of Public Health on the definition of what a disparity is and what equity is, because we wanted to memorialize those concepts outside the government so that there was a tool available to actually use as a standard in that work. So, from the bench to the trench, if you ask me how my career went, I would say I started at the bench and I went to the trench, and some of the milestones along the way here. The very first time I worked with consumers and families was about 1980, and I was very taken with the stories that people told. The stories of their life, the stories of their trauma, the stories of the difficulty of getting care, tremendous stories. And so in these discussions, we took on the issue that there not be a single federal committee in those days operated by the National Institute of Mental Health that did not have primary consumers and family members as part of the committee. And then we had to learn over time that you can't just have one consumer in a group. You need to provide social support to that person. So then we evolved the concept of parity. We're still working on the concept of parity in these committees. And parity would mean if you have a committee of 12 people, six of those people are going to be consumers and family people. We aren't there yet, basically. 1985, the first time I published articles on the issue I'm going to talk about, which is, you know, the background on integration here. And there were very interesting findings. What those findings showed was that people with behavioral health conditions, and this was true of mental illness and substance use, had higher prevalence of chronic diseases, and they got these chronic diseases earlier. So we've known this for a very long time here, as Dave was pointing out. We actually then went on and did another paper and say, well, maybe we ought to begin thinking about a system where the primary care physician is the case manager for a person with serious mental illness. And we published a paper on that. I also was the evaluator for the community support program. So the community support program started off as a little program that had only about $7 to $10 million a year, and then went on to have great influence in how states organized care for people with serious mental illness, and became like the water around the fish, basically. It's in the air, it's everywhere. Everybody takes those concepts for granted. They were not taken for granted in 1985, and there was a huge battle going on because this was in the midst of the Reagan administration, and the Reagan administration was trying to eliminate all pieces of the National Institute of Mental Health that did not deal with research. So they wanted to eliminate the services operation, the training operation, and the CSP. Well, we successfully fought that off, and the CSP survived to live another day and to have the type of influence that it did. 1998, I was involved in writing part of the Surgeon General's report on mental health, and I'll come back to that in a few minutes. And then I was an organizer at the Carter Center in the year 2000 of a separate meeting that the Surgeon General had, and Dave, I believe you were at that meeting, where we said, well, if we're going to do integration, what are the next steps in integration? And we actually produced a report, and it's out on the Surgeon General's website that you can go and read what people were thinking in the year 2000 about integration. So integration is not new. We've been after this for a very long time. I also was a contributor to the President's New Freedom Commission in 2003, where I had the committee that developed the continuum of acute care. The idea that acute care doesn't begin with a hospital bed. It begins with a warm line in a community run by consumers. It has respite beds in the community. It has training of police and CIT. It has EMS people who are trained. And only later do you get to inpatient beds and residential treatment bed, that there's an underlying continuum of services here we need to pay attention to, and so on. And so this was all, we had a committee, this was all written up. We even had a template that you could apply to a community to define what acute care was in that community. I was also the federal project officer for the Institute of Medicine study on improving the quality of health care for persons with mental and substance use conditions. And in those IOM committees, when they begin, they invite the government to the first meeting and say, what does the government want here? Well, I said, what the government wants here is something practical about integration. We don't want the theory of integration. We want practical steps that people can take to integrate behavioral health and primary care. Dave mentioned the article on excess premature mortality for adults. Another step here was actually getting parity in Medicare. From the founding of Medicare until 2007, Part B Medicare payments had a 50% copay for mental health and a 20% copay for everything else. Finally, in 2007 and 8, we were able to change that. I worked on that. Dave worked on that. Other people from Mental Health America worked on that. And we got it changed. But it took till 2014 to actually get it fully implemented. So on January 1st of this year, we finally arrived at the stage where we have parity in Part B Medicare payments. Also, I've done a lot of work on health homes and so on. Dave mentioned the Affordable Care. I've spent most of my time working on the Affordable Care Act in some respects, training people about the Affordable Care Act, talking about health homes, all these types of things. And most recently, I've done analysis of behavioral health primary care integration. I brought a few copies if you would like to have a copy of that, and I'll come to that here as well. For this audience, it's very important to say mental and behavioral health services research and policy and practice are not linked effectively in the United States. So you have kind of like three islands that sit here. So researchers will do their research and they will apply various complex statistical methods. And the policy people will then say, I don't have a clue what this is saying, basically. What is it really telling? Give me the headline or the back of the envelope interpretation of this. So we need to build a better bridge here. And I think the previous session that talked about prevention and promotion would be a call for that same thing. And they actually need very badly to become linked here. So now I'm going to go through our several different levels, and I'll try to go through this quickly. Give a scan of the background of integration. What's the landscape like today? What are some of the solutions? And then moving forward. So first, the scan. Peer support has become absolutely essential. Where did peer support come from? It came from consumers. It did not come from researchers. It did not come from the National Institute of Mental Health. It came from consumers. It's absolutely critical. A quarter of the workforce in the Affordable Care Act era are going to be peer supporters. And we've evolved the concept to even talk about integrated peer supporters. Recovery. Another critical concept. Until the year 2000, we never used the word recovery. In fact, I believe the first formal mention of the word recovery was in the President's New Freedom Commission report, or thereabouts. Where did that concept come from? It came from consumers. Critical, critical. And now resiliency, as we move into prevention and positive health promotion, going to have to develop a whole new lexicon around resiliency. The new will be very different. I'm not kind of getting into my Affordable Care Act talk here. You'll be working in health homes, and researchers will be doing research on health homes, not just separated specialty settings that everybody in this room grew up in. You will be engaged in disease prevention and positive health promotion. You'll also be working directly with communities and populations and not just individuals. So part of this transformation is transforming the field from being purely a clinical field to one that also understands how to do population and community level interventions. And I had the experience this year of having the first person come to me and say, I want a joint degree in social work and public health when I get my master's degree. That's going to become more common as we go forward. So some of the primary background factors. So the Surgeon General's report on mental health was very important to this issue because the concluding chapter of that report said the next decade of work, and that report was written in 1998, is the integration in that report was mental health and primary care. And it was laid out, the rationale for this was well laid out there. We went on to the President's New Freedom Commission. The very first principle in the President's New Freedom Commission was there can be no good health without good mental health and vice versa. The IOM study I mentioned before is a direct outtake of the Surgeon General's report and the New Freedom Commission. Mental health and substance use insurance benefits will be at parity. The Affordable Care Act would not be working for behavioral health had we not gotten parity. Parity is what brought us to the table of health reform. And we can thank Representative Kennedy and others and Dave and his organization, Mental Health America, and Steve Sharfstein and others that made that happen, basically. Recovery is essential. We absolutely have to move in that direction. And the Affordable Care Act then picks up all of these things and brings them together. So a couple of the highlights of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is trying to get universal insurance coverage. And Dave mentioned this, but I'll say the number. So we believe there's still about 7 million people with behavioral health conditions who are qualified for insurance in the Affordable Care Act but are not receiving it. No longer any pre-existing condition exclusion. So beginning at January of this year, no one of any age can be excluded from health insurance in the United States because they have a pre-existing condition. And everybody in this room knows of cases where people with behavioral health conditions have been redlined in the past. Fostering medical and health homes, which I'll come back to a little bit more. Disease prevention and health promotion. Saying, you know, we spend 96 cents out of every dollar on treatment of disease, next to nothing on prevention and promotion. And then we wonder why our costs are escalating dramatically. So, but the vision of the Affordable Care Act is we will be spending about 30% of our health care resources on positive health, not on disease treatment. So we're in the process of beginning to make that transition. It's going to be a huge transition for behavioral health care because we've really historically had next to no field on prevention and absolutely zero field on positive health promotion. Achieving recovery and resiliency. Recovery and resiliency has become a huge part of this. And the Affordable Care Act promotes person-centered care, which is making the person the true north of care. It promotes whole person care, which is really about bringing the various pieces back together and creating integration. And it promotes shared decision making and what's also sometimes called supported decision making. Huge support of the ACA for things that we are trying to do here. Some of the practice developments in the scan here. Obviously, everybody is moving rapidly to managed care. We're beginning to move rapidly toward integrated care and what I would call integrated financing. And I'll come back a little bit to those. There's an enduring concern with cost, an emerging concern with wellness and wellness models, and moving upstream prior to disease care to what now in the private sector is called the culture of health. We now actually know in the private sector, if you work in a company that has a culture of health and promotes positive health in employees, and I contrast that company with one that doesn't, and I have a portfolio of stock for these two sets of companies, the companies that promote the culture of health do better on the stock market. It's actually a paper that's been written and published on this by a guy named Ray Fabius. The goal here is recovery, health, and active, engaged community lives. Political developments. The consumer movement has come of age in both mental health and substance use. We have the National Coalition for Consumer Survivor Organizations and Mental Health. We have Favor, Faces and Voices of Recovery and Substance Use. Recovery is an essential care motivator. People don't come to care to treat their symptoms. They come to care to have a life. Weakening and integration of state mental health and substance use agencies. So if I were standing here and predicting, I would say 10 years from now, many more state mental health and substance use agencies will have disappeared, and they will have disappeared into state health agencies and state Medicaid agencies. Health entities are in ascendancy, so we need to be paying attention to what the hospitals are doing, what primary care practices are doing, what federally qualified health centers are doing, and so on. So, go quickly through these because you all know these numbers here. We have a very big problem. So for adults, about 5.8% of the population at any given time has a serious mental illness. Children, about 8 million or 10% of the population. In any given year, adults, 55 million, about 25% of the adult population, and children, about 16 million. The critical fact is in red here. One-third of adults and two-thirds of children with these disorders receive no services at all. And that's still true today. And two-thirds of other people with these disorders don't receive any care. And a huge factor in that is not having insurance and not having access to providers. Substance use, even a bleaker picture, about 24 million potential cases per year, of which only about 2.4 receive any care. So the penetration of care into that population is only about 10%. And most of the care is paid for currently with the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant. What are the causes of this for substance use? Substance use in 1998 was excluded as a condition of disability in the Supplemental Security Income and the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. Other funding sources have been flat, so the Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant probably has increased only about $100 million in the last 15 years. And American society has criminalized substance use. So my call here is we have to decriminalize people with substance use conditions. And so the political foray is on to begin that work right now, and you'll see much more about that in future years here. Mortality, we've mentioned that several times. 25 years of life lost for an adult with serious mental illness in the public mental health system. The data we had was from the late 90s and early 2000s. The one more recent study I know of in one state, their number actually did not improve in the intervening time. It got worse. It went from 25 to 29 years. And that's absolutely tragic, basically. And we really must do something about that. If I take a person who is an adult with serious mental illness and I add substance use to it, I can get the numbers up to 35 years. So I'm talking about somebody dying 40 to 45 years old. And again, you all know people who have had substance use conditions who died in those age ranges. If you look at this, and you won't be able to see it well from the distance, but the main thing is the bars. So on the left, you have a bar for the United States. What do people die of? The most prominent thing that people die of is heart disease and cancer, the two tallest bars. If I look in Missouri, 1997, that was also true in Missouri. And then if I look in Missouri mental health, who died, who was in the public mental health system in Missouri, those are the two primary causes. The essential difference between Missouri for everybody and Missouri for mental health is that the people in the third set are dying 25 years earlier of the same diseases that other people die of. That was the primary finding. Wellness miles. I have to get into this a little bit. So 35 years ago, we did a paper, and we were trying to think through the concept of what would be called a health promotion organization. So we did two papers. One was a theoretical paper, which has this particular model in it, and the other one was a paper on how you actually would structure a health promotion organization. And I think that paper actually would fit better today than it did 35 years ago. So the basic underlying idea of the theoretical paper is that health and illness are not two ends of the same continuum. They're two different continua. So if I go back to the World Health Organization definition of health, which is in the preamble to the Constitution of the World Health Organization, it said health is a complete state of mental, physical, social, and emotional well-being, and not simply the absence of disease. So in one illness here, you have disease and the absence of disease, and then you have health as another dimension, which is where that idea came from. Here's an application of this in behavioral health. Moving horizontally, you do traditional biopsychosocial interventions. Moving vertically, you get into some other dimensions, self-help, social support, changes in unhealthy lifestyle, and so on. We can go on and apply that same model to prevention, and I didn't develop this in the previous hour, but I'll spend a minute here developing it. So if I believe that health is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being, then it becomes very important for me to become health literate about the things that promote my good physical, mental, and social health. What are those things? It's equally as important to become literate about those things that serve as triggers for illness, what we now call here health activation. So a health activated person understands the triggers in their own makeup that lead them to have an episode of disease. For example, someone with depression. A very common trigger for depression is lack of sleep. So if you have a person who is getting less and less sleep, who has depression, the probability is going up that they're going to affect that trigger. So if you're going to work on your own health, you need to understand positive physical, mental, and social health. You also need to understand the triggers, and about both, you need to become health literate. The essential ideas, you're going to hear these words a lot more. There's a parallel to these concepts in a community. So the community will do the same thing. So a community has effects on physical, mental, and social well-being. It's important to have literacy about that community and find out what are the things in that community that actually are promoting positive health and what are the things that are detracting from it, and then become activated about this and understand what are the triggers in that community that decrease the health of people in that community. So I'm simply making the case there's a set of concepts here at a personal level, there's a parallel set of concepts here at the organizational or community level. Which then leads to this type of diagram. It has the same two dimensions. You have disease, no disease on the horizontal dimension, and health, no health on the vertical dimension. We spend all of our time now in the lower right-hand quadrant. We will be moving under the Affordable Care Act into these other quadrants. So the first one we're going to move to is the upper one in right, on the right, where you're getting into wellness. That's already well underway in behavioral health. And again, this is being fostered mainly by consumers and peers. You soon, down on the left in green, disease prevention and positive health promotion. much less going on in that cell right now, but more will be happening. And then finally, the upper left-hand cell, you in the future health, working with people who don't have any disease and who come with a very strong culture of health to begin with. That's a complete headset change for behavioral health care that we're in the very early phases of. What are some of the implications of that? You got to provide primary care, got to provide mental health and substance use care. Facilitation of health, wellness, and recovery approaches becomes essential in that. Care integration becomes an obvious mechanism to achieve these goals. You have great potential to work with health homes to deliver needed care to clients who have physical illnesses but no behavioral health conditions. So when I talk about an integrated peer supporter, that's one concept of what that integrated peer supporter would be doing. You also have great potential to implement disease prevention and health promotion interventions in health homes and in public health programs. And so I challenge the section of opening the doors more to the other sections here, the medical care section, the medical management and administration section, the ATOD section. We need to be working more closely with these people. Prevention and promotion. And we got into this in the last sense. Always better to prevent than to treat. Always better to intervene earlier rather than later. It's always better to intervene with populations rather than person, but you always got to assess the effects of what you're doing. If you don't assess the effects, it's like you never know what the outcome was. We need to have new partners. These new partners at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. You need to know what the guide to community preventive services is. This is community and population level interventions that are evidence-based. And the guide to clinical prevention services, intervention services for individuals. Now I'm going to just quickly go into one of the dimensions of the Affordable Care Act quality reform. There are five reforms here: insurance reform, coverage reform, quality reform, payment reform, and performance reform. The only one I'm going to talk about is quality reform. The link here is to the article that summarizes these five areas. So the highlight here, the Affordable Care Act provides for the creation of integrated health homes which offer prevention and promotion as well as care. Mental health and substance use care providers will need to become part of accountable care organizations that operate health homes. Obvious. How is this going to happen? Section 2703 of the Affordable Care Act provides resources for states to create Medicaid state plan amendments to implement health homes, and they can be specific to our populations. Adults with serious mental illness and children with serious emotional disturbance and adults with serious substance use disorders are specifically recognized in Section 2703. And the advantage of Section 2703 and having your state apply for it is the fact that the federal government will pay 90% of the cost for the first 8 quarters, the first 2 years. So when you go home, you should investigate whether your state has done one of these for adults with serious mental illness and adults with serious substance use disorder. And if not, why not? Because there's a huge opportunity here. Accountable care organizations, you're going to hear more about that as well. Accountable care organizations are the organizational entities that will operate health homes. And they can be either umbrella organizations that bring together other organizations that do this, or they can be fully integrated accountable care organizations. The challenge in behavioral health is we need to be creating some of these. They shouldn't all be created by primary care practices and hospitals. And they're called accountable for a reason. They will be called to accountability through quality measures. And that will happen, basically. So our grand challenge here in quality is how can we foster the development of health homes and accountable care organizations without losing many of our provider organizations along the way? And I would say many mental health organizations and many substance use organizations are not prepared for this. Solutions. Okay, so I'm now coming to the article that Roger and I did a few months ago. I'll kind of go through a high level of this. We envision three models here for integration. Model one, what we call treat refer, cross referral. I come to my psychiatrist. The psychiatrist says, well, you know, you really need to see a primary care physician. I'm going to send you to Dave Schoen. I go out, I never arrive at Dave Schoen's office. That's the problem of treat refer. Huge problem here. So we developed the second model, what we call bidirectional integration, to overcome the problems of treat refer. What bidirectional integration has become pretty much is what I would call co-location. So I have a primary care office sitting next door to a behavioral health operation. Or vice versa. In a behavioral health entity, I will have a primary care office there. And many of you are from universities. Surely you know in universities you can sit next door to people for years and not even know who they are and definitely not know what they're working on. That's a huge problem here. It's a huge problem. So we said, well, we got to move on to the next level, what we call fully integrated services. And fully integrated services really has two characteristics. One, we have fully integrated treatment teams that include primary care people, behavioral health specialists, and peers. And secondly, we have fully integrated money, meaning carve out, carve in, all of this will go away, and the money will be fully integrated. How do you protect the money when it's fully integrated? You protect it with performance measures, which we also advocate for. So that's the kind of the underlying logic. I won't go through this overhead. This overhead outlines characteristics of each of those models with respect to access, integrated care delivery, payment, and outcomes. So you should be able to take your organization and characterize it where you are in each of these dimensions. And for access, you may be at level two, but on integrated care delivery, you may be at level one. It's a good exercise to go through for your organization to help your organization understand steps, practical steps that will be necessary. Now, so the way the world is currently configured here is the physical health sector provides about 75% of all the behavioral health treatment given in the United States. You see that little tiny circle on the right. However, less than 5% of behavioral health specialists do any work in the physical health care sector at all. So if I were saying, what's a huge opportunity area going forward? That's a huge opportunity area for behavioral health. Then you come down here to the behavioral health sector. Behavioral health sector covers about 25% of all care given. It has 95% of the behavioral health specialists and less than 1% of the practicing primary care specialists. So a huge opportunity for primary care people will be to work in behavioral health. This is a cost analysis. The critical thing here is the lower right-hand cell. Behavioral health costs in 2012, and Stephen Melick, who does this, is a very credible person, a total of $444 billion. And that's for behavioral health care and all primary care for anybody who had at least one behavioral health claim in a year. So it's absolutely huge. So that represents 27.5% of all health care dollars spent in the United States right now. And I would say the time is ticking, the clock is ticking on that number, because we need to do better than that. And you look at the relative differential, only $91 billion is spent in behavioral health care. All the rest is spent in primary care. There's huge opportunities for improving that. So model three, if we would go out 10 years and predict 10 years from now, we would say, well, 10 years from now, we expect that 90% of all behavioral health care will be given in health homes operated out of the primary care sector, and about 10% will be given in health homes operated out of behavioral health. And then this overhead goes through some of the characteristics there. So some of the forward steps, and I won't perseverate too much longer here. What are some of your fears about integrating behavioral health and primary care? So I do a lot of trainings in this. The very first thing we do when we talk is we talk about our fears. Because the rationale is there to do this. What's preventing it from happening is psychological fear. Secondly, what steps are you and your organization planning to take, prepare for integration? Are you planning any new partnerships? This is not the era of doing things alone. This is the era of partnerships. What vision, strategy, tactics do you think will be necessary to accomplish integration in the short term and longer term? And how do you plan to work with your health insurance exchange and your Medicaid expansion to do this, basically? So if we do all these things, what would we expect? I would expect longevity to increase. I would expect that 25 years to go down. A huge part of the reason we have the 25 years is because people, even if they get behavioral health care, don't get any primary care. And so their chronic physical illnesses remain untreated, and they kill them at a younger age. Recovery to improve disability and community tenure. Community tenure to improve full community participation. We would also expect greater attention to the social and physical determinants of health because the Affordable Care Act is going to keep moving us that way. The goals in Healthy People 2020 move us in that direction. More community participation in addressing local health issues. Less stigma in the community. And you ought to read what Bill White has written about stigma of people with substance use conditions in primary care practices. Huge issue. Much greater recognition that all health and health care is local. So if I had a heart attack right now and fell over, Dave would come running up and they'd call the EMS and take me to a local hospital. I would live or die depending on the quality of care in that hospital and how many times a year they treat somebody with that condition. All health and health care ultimately is local, and quality is a local phenomenon here. Takeaways, social justice, we're on the right side of the issue. We do have services that can decrease health disparities and promote equity, and we should be proud about the services that we have. And our clients can and will become productive citizens in a global economy, and we're working and made a lot of progress on that. So with that, I'm going to stop. Show you my contact information. Thank you all very much. I thank Shariki again for coming and Dave Shern for making his nice comments. Thank you all for coming and joining me. And I get, are we having a Q&A here? Okay, so we'll open it up for a Q&A.
So, questions, comments, reactions? Yeah.
I'm an expert today. I'm a primary care physician and part of the ATOD section. So the integration has begun, apparently. And my question for you is, you mentioned that the state mental health and substance abuse agencies would be expected to disappear. I wonder if you think that that same structural change has to happen at the national level. There's an agency known as
Good question. Very good question. So it's already underway in the states, and California has done this. So California has eliminated its mental health agency and its substance use agent. I think the question this group and other groups in behavioral health need to take on, not right now, but in the next administration, is the question, what is going to happen at the national level as the Affordable Care Act becomes more consolidated and whoever is the Secretary of HHS says, we are not organized to map onto the Affordable Care Act. And so we need to have an opinion about that. You can go one of two ways. You could go one way and say, you know, I think we need to strengthen SAMHSA, but we need to increase the linkages between SAMHSA and HRSA and CMS and CDC and so on. Or you could go the other way and say, well, I think, you know, the logical future here is to collapse SAMHSA and HRSA into an integrated entity of some type, and maybe even with CMS. And you should know as a historical footnote, at the time we did Clinton Health Reform, which is now about 15 years ago, that very issue came up. And the recommendation of the Assistant Secretary for Health, not the Secretary, but the Assistant Secretary for Health, would have been take SAMHSA and HRSA and CMS and put them together into an integrated health agency. That did not happen for political reasons at that time, but that's an idea that's already an old idea that's been out there about 15 years. But my encouragement here would be we got to create the dialogue to help create our own future rather than simply sit here and say, is this going to happen? We need to become engaged in the issue, basically.
Yeah, right here.
Vicki May, I am in California, so.
Okay. Good question. Very good question. So the way I would define the terms that I use, I would say a medical home is an integrated entity that has primary care and behavioral health that's operated out of the medical sector. And a health home is an integrated entity that offers behavioral health and primary care that's offered out of the behavioral health sector. So I don't make the assumption that everything will be ultimately operated out of primary care. So if you make the assumption of health homes, then I think you also can make the assumption that some health homes are going to be operated by behavioral health people, and they're going to be managed by behavioral health people, and you're going to actually have teams where behavioral health people lead the team. We actually have examples of that. So in Oregon, Oregon has created 15 community care organizations, and one of those organizations, GOBI, is actually operated by a behavioral health person. So we have examples of this that are up and running already. This is not any longer a hypothetical. So I always say when people say, you know, where should you go to see how this is beginning to shake out, I would send you to look at what Oregon is doing in the CCOs, the community care organizations that have mental health, substance use, primary care, public health is already there in Oregon. Some of them also have dental services, and some of them have vaccination services. So I would encourage you to look at what they're doing, and I can put you in link with the GOBI people if you would like to talk with them.
Another interesting thing about Oregon is that one of their CCOs is actually using Medicaid funds to fund a universal primary prevention intervention, the Good Behavior Gap, in Lane County, which is where Eugene is. So that's one of the first examples of actually using a health insurance premium to pay for primary prevention, which can be very important. Yes, right there, and then we'll come back over here.
I'm Warren Hewitt, formerly of SAMHSA. And Ron, very good conversation that you've had here today. I ran the first primary care integration grants that came out of my SAMHSA in 1992-93. These were focused around HIV. One of the biggest challenges there we found in integrating was that, number one, we talked different languages.
Right.
I mean, just on
Patient,
client, you know, at that level. We had different perspectives about the patients that we were seeing and the multiple disease entities that were affected with. But the critical thing was that nobody talked to each other. So social workers didn't talk to physicians, physicians didn't talk to psychologists.
Yep.
And none of them were really clear about how to impact patients who had HIV on board, but who also had behavioral health.
Yeah.
The remedy that we used was I brought all the medical directors together. And I said, okay, you need some retraining. So I had some of my colleagues at ASAM, the American Society for Addiction Medicine, begin to talk to them about the themes that resonated within substance abuse treatment and HIV for them. And we actually got people to begin that process of communication. Now, in terms of where we're going, don't we need a companion strategy, perhaps, in the medical schools at AAMC?
Absolutely.
At the schools of social work,
absolutely.
Psychology, to begin to prepare people for the lexicon of integration, both in their practice and their theoretical approaches,
No, very good comment. Agree completely, and actually saw a survey about 6 months ago of primary care physicians who want additional training to begin understanding these areas. So this is actually now coming from the grassroots in that field and saying, you know, we need to have different training in medical school. We need to have different continuing education, all these things to reflect the changed world we're entering here, and that we never got enough of this when we actually did go to medical school. So I think the point is very, very well taken.
Jennifer? No, go the way in the back.
So I think, you know, the policy statement that the section developed over the last 2 years is very helpful in moving prevention and health promotion. You probably need similar work on integration. I don't know that you all have done that. I don't think so. You probably also need some work on measures, maybe as part of the work on integration, to get into measures of well-being and health-related quality of life, some of these key things that, again, in healthy people we defined as the foundation health measures that have not made their way out into the field. So I can go all over in behavioral health. I don't ever hear anybody talk about that. They're going to become very important things because, as I said this morning, I heard someone speak about a month ago, and they talked about prevention creating an absence. Well, you can't measure an absence, in effect. You got to have something positive. Well, the positive thing is, have I promoted positive health in you, and how have I measured it in a comparable way across populations? So there's a huge agenda here in integration. I think there's also a huge agenda in changing the model of services research from what it is now, which is what I would call specialized, segregated services research, to integrated services research, and opening the doors to projects that span across these different background areas. Another huge opportunity. Be great to have a policy statement come out of the section on that, basically.
Way in the back.
Kristen Weiler, also formerly of SAMHSA.
Okay. Thank you for raising that. So part of the work on the Affordable Care Act is to make people aware that when they do the state health insurance marketplace and the Medicaid expansion, what they are actually doing is supplanting state and local dollars with federal dollars. So then you've got to ask the question, where are those supplanted dollars going? Well, those supplanted dollars are the dollars that used to provide what we call social wraparound services, supported housing, supported employment, transportation, and so on. We don't dare let those dollars go off the table because we need them for exactly the services you're talking about. And I would be so bold as to say your health services will fail you in these populations if you don't do the social wraparound that people need. So it's a very, very, very important point. And so when I'm back 25 years from now talking again about integration, we're going to be integrating not only behavioral health and primary care, but also social services. But I think that goes the next generation of integration, and we're not quite there yet, basically. But the point is very well taken.
It is. Excellent point, Crystal. Rick?
Rick, I'm at the University of Boston. As you know, I've been working the last 2 years on looking at the mental health costs of the Boston bombings. And what's been coming out of that really resonates here. In the last 3 months, we've had 3 new centers formed in Boston, which will go in the future. One's a resiliency center, which opened its doors 3 weeks ago. Another is an integration of Mass General, which brings behavioral health together with tinnitus and the whole parity challenge. So we're starting to see that. And the third is being run out of the Boston Public Health Commission, which is for the folks who are not victims of the bombings, but the folks who die every day and who get challenged. All of which are integrated models, not providing the care yet, but a one-stop place that you can come, you can get services, you can get referrals to services. And as I get more and more involved with the disaster folks at APHA, again, I think we've learned mental health is part of that. I think
moving
the disaster stuff is going to help move us towards the right direction. Talking about, because we know it has worked in Boston.
Excellent, excellent. So I assume people can contact you to learn more about these activities and link in.
I have a closing session, I guess, at 8:30 to 9:30 on Wednesday morning.
Okay, excellent.
Excellent. Somebody else, Jeannie, and that, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jeannie, and I'll get you next, okay? Sorry.
Okay, so I'm Jeannie, I'm a member of the
So first, I guess my prediction would be ultimately every state will be doing the Medicaid expansion. We just aren't there politically yet. And I think as the years go by, not doing it becomes more and more politically untenable for the people that are preventing it from happening. Because what the hospital industry will withdraw its support from those politicians because they say, you know, we're losing our disproportionate share money from Medicaid and Medicare to run our emergency departments and so on, where it could all be replaced with these other funds. So you're putting us into an economic hardship. So I think the politics of that runs in favor of more and more states doing this over time. However, the trick is doing it in a way so it's not called the Medicaid expansion, it's not called Obamacare, it's called something else. Texas First, Iowa Health, all these things to get the money, but not call it the Medicaid expansion. So you need to help change the name in your own state if you're from a state that isn't actually doing this. Now, the Section 2703 is not dependent upon doing the Medicaid expansion. So you can get Section 2703, Medicaid state plan amendments, without ever doing the Medicaid expansion. So, you know, I go work both sides of the street, so to speak.
A couple more questions. Yeah, right there.
We got you.
I think we have to have a conversation about, you know, who's on first to get a sense of how we move forward with this notion of integration.
Right.
The other thing is, I think that I worked on the CHIP. Many of you may not know what CHIP was, but it was a model for the Obama plan.
Yep.
And also for the Carter and the basically all the other health insurance plans. This is a Nixon plan. The biggest problem that we had was this fear about what the cost of mental health, and I bring that forward now to behavioral health, would be in an environment where we gave a benefit to, and at that time it was psychotherapy that they were concerned about. I think we have a number of pieces of mythology that we need to set right with in our field and in terms of our dealings with those outside of our field. The final thing is that I think we have to have a much clearer idea of measures. You know, we use the term serious mental illness, and I personally favor us looking at some of the disease entities, looking at depression, looking at anxiety disorders, post-traumatic stress, because we see those in our population. We need to be able to look at that in a much more dynamic sense.
Yeah.
And I think that would improve our ability to integrate more efficiently and more effectively.
Excellent points. I think there's a whole literature on integrated teams that you ought to be looking at here. And we need to explore different ways of doing those integrated teams, and we need to do evaluation research on how those integrated teams work, basically. And I think right now very little of that work is underway. You may be the one to, you know, take on some of these projects here. Or some of the others of you who do services research, take on some of those projects, because we need practical, it's the same thing I said when we did the IOM study, we want practical outputs from this and not theory of how this should work, basically.
Greg?
Greg T.
No.
Well, what you're, I think, saying is that the work you've been doing focuses on clinical interventions and getting them out, and now there's a whole new set of approaches of getting population and community interventions with evidence-based practices out there, and that will require training. It'll require work with people who have public health backgrounds such as you have, and we need to have more people in the field trained in public health backgrounds. Exactly.
Services, that number should be expected to get worse before it gets better.
So I guess I would hope you would invest your money first in services for that population, but also in data. So, and Dave, I think, has been involved in this as well. We've been for years trying to get the federal government to collect annular mortality data on every single state so we know what actually is happening out there. And such data are very important, and the closest we ever get to that kind of data is the system that Dave mentioned, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, because there's no national data system that actually collects what we really need. And so, you know, I can tell you, you know, that one state went from 25 to 29. I have no idea what happened to the other 49 because there's absolutely no data. So I think it's very absolutely critical that we have data. But I think, you know, as we do that, we also have to invest in services so what you're saying doesn't actually happen here. No, because if you're getting more people in treatment, the third who've never been in treatment, you know next to nothing about them, basically.
Well, you give a comment, or you just call
time? We can make it a comment.
Okay.
Tell them where the reception is so that everybody knows.
Yeah.